This is The Liminalist, the podcast between Jason Horsley talking to Branko Malik of Carly Tribune.
Calling me from USA, is it not?
Canada.
Canada? I thought you are an Englishman.
I'm an Englishman in Canada.
Yeah, I live in Canada. I recognize the accent.
Yeah.
I listened to your interview with David Livingstone. That's how I know about your podcasts.
All right.
Because it was a great interview. I have some mutual friends with David, so I was interested. And David is not really giving much interviews lately in the last few years. It's very hard to catch him talking. I was really interested.
All right.
And it was pretty good.
Oh, good. Well, thanks. Yeah, I heard about you. I think I mentioned from a listener. And so that was what led me to your stuff. And to be honest, I don't generally talk to other researchers. I suspect you feel the same way. I don't really like most of the other researchers. You know, I get a whiff of them, and that's it. I'm not interested in talking to this person. So, but I found your stuff refreshingly. Well, I'm not sure what adjective to use at this point because I just begun. I listened to a couple more podcasts last night. I mean, very intense, very. Rigorous and analytical, and obviously you really seem to be very knowledgeable. You seem to be quite young, was one question I had, based on how
I am
much
not.
You're not
everybody. Please continue. I'm sorry.
It's okay, everybody thinks that.
Yeah, I'm 42. I'm not young at all.
Oh, okay. Right.
Yeah, I look young and sound young, but I'm not. Unfortunately.
Okay. Well, actually 42 is pretty young, but yeah, not as young as I thought by the sound of your voice. But it was a conflict because obviously your knowledge and your experience signaled older person, but something else signaled younger. So it's just, it made me curious about that.
Well, that's because I am, as I like to say, a half-baked academic. I was, at one point in my life, I was going into academic career, but then give it up from the reasons of being, I'd say, rebellious and so on. And maybe I picked up that academic vibe, you know, that gives you kind of this gravitas. I'm not that knowledgeable. I am, as I like to say, half amateur academic, because you see, all the people, all we people who do this work via internet have a great problem of not being critically assessed enough by colleagues, while if we were working on university, you would always have these other people criticizing you methodically and so on. And this is very good to develop a huge ego and undevelop your critical faculties, unfortunately. And this happens to a lot of alt media personalities, I'd say.
Right. Yeah. I would agree with that. And I think that's part of what. Why I resist speaking to other researchers, and the tendency to turn research into a platform for a sort of personality cult, I suppose, really summing it up, my distaste for that.
Yes, and it is very prevalent. Unfortunately, I had been very sorely disappointed in a lot of people I've been in contact with on personal level, more than on this level of, I don't know, knowledge, because I thought them as some kind of friends. I guess you can't really make friends over internet. It's an illusion. But really, this kind of platform for ego tripping, most of alt media is that right now.
Yeah.
Maybe 90% even.
Yeah, well, it's the way
with
of the
some
world.
Some exceptions. Yeah, probably, yes.
So I was listening to your most recent podcast last night about the overpopulation and Aztec sacrifice, and I was struck right away because of the you brought up Bataille, and I don't know if you noticed. I know that you just glanced at Prisoner of Infinity, but I don't know if you glanced long enough to see that that was actually the launch point for Prisoner of Infinity was Geoffrey Kripal writing about Georges Bataille.
I just skimmed through it. Problem is, I never read Battaglia. I'm just going to start reading him because I will do review of that Preparatas book I talked in that podcast. But from what I know of Battaglia, he's more or less on point with Heidegger, of which I know quite a lot about, let's say. Alexander Dugin, a lot of these thinkers we might call postmodernists, and they all share this kind of fixation on a nihilism as a springboard for their thought. And what is especially interesting to me is they cut through left and right political spectrum. They can pose as traditionalists. For instance, very good example is this Russian, let's call him thinker. I would call him charlatan, Alexander Dugin, who is making rounds in the West and who infected a lot of alternative, let's say, internet-based intellectual circles, especially if they are right-leaning, but also a radical left. And this is something that what I meant to say, Bataille is not really. I'm not really knowledgeable about him, but from what I read in these passages in Preparata, I think I have a cl I have a. Let's say pretty clear picture what kind of man we are talking about. He fits in the mold.
Well, I'm not knowledgeable about Bataille either, and Prisoner of Infinity was a strange project because it, I mean, it ended up as a book-length study and actually a book next year about Whitley Strieber, but it began as an email exchange with this guy Geoffrey Kripal. Do you know who he is?
No.
Okay, so he's well, on the surface, he's an academic in that world, Rice University, and also the Institute of Noetic Sciences. He's affiliated with those guys, but he's written several semi-populist books about the esoteric. Authors of the Impossible was one, which is about Charles Fort and Jacques Vallée and a couple of other, cultural figures. Mutants and Mystics was about the sort of mapping the correlation between spirituality and sort of pop culture of mutants and stuff. And then this recent book with Whitley Strieber, the supernatural, or yeah, the supernatural. And so, anyway, I had a sort of informal email correspondence with him, and at a certain point, he sent me this essay that he'd written about Georges Bataille for a compendium of essays about Bataille. I'd never heard of Bataille, and the premise of his article was that extreme trauma can lead to enlightened states. And he correlated this with Georges Bataille on taboo and. Well, whatever else. I mean, I just quoted some to Bataille. I didn't dig any deeper. But anyway, this led to this argument, this email discussion or whatever with Kripal, where I just basically flatly disagreed. I said, this is not true.
Yes.
Trauma does not lead to enlightenment. It can lead to dissociation and, visionary states that can be mistaken for that, but that's not the real thing. And it's very important to make that distinction. And he just kept coming back saying, I don't know what you mean. Like he kept acting as though he really didn't know what that I was like splitting hairs or something. Anyway, and then that led me to look at, because Kripal is friends with Whitley Strieber and had written about Strieber and mutants and mystics. So, and Strieber is promoting trauma as a means to enlightenment through his experiences or his account. Anyway, just that's just a summation of the whole of Prisoner of Infinity. Essentially, was exploring that whole meme or memeplex, if we call it that. And I didn't look more into Bataille because I was, I was focusing on Kreipl and then Strieber, and so I got further and further from Bataille. But still, he was, in a certain sense, he was the foundation of that discussion and that exploration. And certainly, I did get a sense of this, the avocation of taboo and the breaking of taboo as a means towards liberation, which of course is Satanism, or corresponds with Satanism. And as you point out, nihilism. So it does. I mean, it was just curious that you brought it up because it. I don't know. I mean, one of the things that I'm always wrestling with, that I brought up with David Livingstone, is, how much am I mapping an ideology here that's a sort of hidden ideology? And there's these different proponents, and some of them are witting and some of them aren't. And never quite knowing, like, how much Kreipl is consciously promoting this nihilistic, neo-satanic agenda, basing it a lot on Bataille, and that this is a tradition that exists, and how much is he oblivious? Well, I still don't know. So, it was just interesting to me anyway that you brought Bataille up as a foundational figure in that way.
The reason why I brought it up is because the author of the book I was quoting, Guido Preparata, wrote a book, The Ideology of Tyranny, with a thesis that is precisely that Georges Bataille is the founding father of this, how would I call it, this nihilistic or even satanist leaning political philosophy, which is dominating the thinkers, official thinkers of left and right, like, for instance, Michel Foucault or Leo Strauss on the right, Heidegger, and he mentions also Ernest Jünger, although some people told me that Preparata misquoted Jünger, that Jünger was not so much infected with this, and he's precisely that's I'm saying this because that's why I brought up Bataille only as a side note, because this is the thesis of the book I just read. And I think, well, to put Bataille for a moment aside, this process of a subversion of mainstream by the radical idea is, in my opinion, always a process from the fringe towards the center. For instance, you have a guy who is, or group of people, who come up with this most extreme idea, as this one you pointed out about enlightenment to trauma, which is monstrous idea, which is idea that is shared also, interestingly enough, by people like Dugin, for instance, from his younger days. It really rang the bell when you mentioned this idea. This is, I like to sum it up under the term Gnosticism, because it has this Gnostic over neo-Gnostic overtones, and those ideas cannot be taken in by public nor by the mainstream politicians and in academics in their pure form, of course. So they get promulgated in a sugar-coated versions, and but they slowly permeate the mainstream. And I think the situation now in the West, at least, not so much where I live. I am in Croatia, that's let's say Eastern to Central Europe, but this is a rather different place than, for instance, Germany and France and England and the southwestern states. We are not so much infected with this radical identity politics, for instance. I think that brands of, for instance, this identity politics we sometimes call political correctness, if it comes from the left, or what is promulgated by alt-right, I in fact they're coming they were on the fringe once. Alt-right is still on the fringe, but this leftist variation we call political correctness was also a fringe, I don't know, maybe 25 years ago or 30 years ago.
Right.
And then they slowly burrow their way into mainstream by I'd say mostly by changing the language, by infiltrating the language with their terminology. But their hardcore is extreme and radical, as what would Batal say, just to reiterate this idea that salvation or salvation, quote unquote, or transcendence of the inauthentic way of living of modern man is possible through transgression, through pain, suffering, violence, and so on. And those are satanic ideas. I have given a look to few of those interesting and scary, frankly, strands of ideology. For instance, I don't know if you ever heard of Order of the Nine Angles.
Only via your writing, yeah.
Ah, you read that. I wrote about them, for instance. They are probably, they posed as a satanic order, but I think that was one man. And that the idea of this man who wrote under the pseudonym Anton Long was to use this rather refined philosophical satanism to draw people into radical politics, most radical politics imaginable, terrorist politics, politics of violence for the sake of violence, for instance, politics of total transgression. And I noticed that this the way of thinking of this ideology is very how should I put it? Has a very good medium in internet. It's very well promulgated via internet, and because a lot of people in the last, let's say, 15 to 20 years started doing these podcasts, these independent websites, I think those ideas, not only this Order of the Nine Angles, nihilism, or it can be something else, really infected people doing this quote-unquote alternative research, especially if they are right-leaning politically. you meant to say something.
Well, yeah, I was groping for something, because there's quite a few different strands here. But one of the things, like you mentioned in this podcast I listened to, I don't remember if it was the Aztec one or the, I also listened to Researching Evil, that one, a slightly older one. But anyway, you brought up how extreme political movements, I'm paraphrasing here, but and social change and whatnot, has its origin in grassroots phenomena, which is what you're touching on now. I'm just going to try and extrapolate all this and end with a question, I guess. But I mean, you talk about, for example, the correspondence between left and right. If you go deep enough, you see that they're actually congruent. Well, that's something I never really doubted. I mean, I never had many illusions about that. We could go into my background if we have time, because I was raised by socialists and they were elitists, so that I saw that paradox. I grew up with it, so I've never had many illusions about that. But I think another variation on this is the supposed dichotomy between nihilism and spirituality, because a lot of the people I look at, they may even seem grassrootsy, but they definitely seem spiritually inclined. Like you mentioned Gnosticism, well, that's a thread running through all kinds of different things. And somebody like Jeffrey Kripal, well, on the surface, he seems to be promoting spiritual ideas, you know, positive values, self-empowerment, compassion for others, a sentient universe, and so on, you know, very spiritual notions. But underneath, there does seem to be this more nihilistic thread running through it. So I'm just wondering, you know, if you've observed that also, and what you think about that, and if that also relates to the way in which something like Nazism, to use the really easy example, National Socialism, it did seem to emerge from seeming grassroots alternate spiritual ideologies and memes.
It was, well, I wouldn't call it so much grassroots as fringe. It was a fringe, although it historically, I think National Socialism called on fertile ground because of the chaos in Germany of that age, but these Tulebund, this organization that was nucleus for early national German National Socialist Workers' Party, they were really a kind of, I wouldn't call them occult society. There is no evidence, I think, about them that they were indulging the occult in this magical sense. They were more occult in the way that they were a debate club, somewhat underground debate club, but they were fringe people. And I think one great problem today is that people think, let's call them grassroots people like you and I, and probably people that will listen to this podcast, think of themselves as opposed to establishment. And not necessarily hostile, but they are not establishment. So there are some kind of elites, and we are some kind of multitude. And the main mistake everybody makes is thinking that the very fact that you are fringe, that you are grassroots, means that you are good. That doesn't mean that at all. You can have a rather rational and good establishment. I mean, at least you can imagine it existing. Whereas you can have a multitude of grassroots people ready to lynch somebody or devising all kinds of crazy ideas, and can be very easily infected by crazy and destructive ideas. And I think internet is very people who are using internet to gain knowledge are very susceptible to this, because the more you identify, in my opinion, with your virtual avatar, with your persona on internet, which is never really identical with who you are in a real life, the more you identify with it, the more you are susceptible to viral ideas, because the more you are becoming kind of internet node.
Right.
And Most of those, for instance, the movements, as I'll take an example of alt-right, those are completely internet-based movements, and they are based on memes, on cynical humor, and on whole plethora of ideas, some kind of pseudo-traditionalism, on ideas of thinkers of the, let's call them far right, like Julius Evola or somebody like that, and so on and so forth. And I think that they are very susceptible to be manipulated in all kinds of ways, precisely because they are on internet. They are trying to reach the reality, to become a real political movement with a real with a clout in real life. But I think they are not very good that very good at that. But what is very dangerous in this is not so much, in my opinion at least, the social danger of people who got infected, for instance, with idea as Order of the Nine Angles, where you have an idea that you should, at least in the early days of Order of the Nine Angles, one of the recommended ways of conduct was to make a human sacrifice every now and then. I don't think many people are capable of doing that, something like this. But what happens is that people who get sucked in this kind of ideas are at a great peril to their own soul, to their own inner being, because they got corrupted. One good instance is Alexander Dugin. I always return to him because I'm doing a lot of research on Dugin, who is extremely popular in the West. I mean, in the internet public, but he's also recognized as a significant intellectual enemy by outlets as Financial Times, for instance. And I do a lot of work on Dugin because I can read his books in Serbian, or even if I focus real hard in Russian. And he doesn't, what he speaks and writes in Russian or Serbian will not always be the same what he'll speak or write in English. So people are really not sure what he's talking about. And he, for instance, that's unbelievable. He's capable of absorbing into his network, loose network, the people from completely disparate sides of political spectrum. That is, first nationalists from Eastern Europe, who are very often at each other's throats. But he somehow manages to co-opt them. Then he co-opts, as his adherents or adherents of his ideas, the leftists, anti-imperialists, quote-unquote leftists, who are always hell-bent on sticking it to empire, as they say, to NATO, USA, and so on. And the trouble is with people like Dugin. One of the Russian, let's say, Russian thinkers, pundits, who have probably close ties with maybe even the Russian deep state, and they are doing the bidding of some political options in Russia, which are not good in any way. And they are not necessarily doing the bidding of somebody in the sense that they got ordered around. They are just used. They are useful and tolerated. And the main idea, for instance, in Dugin is what he says, delendare Carthago. He destroyed the Carthage because he likens America with Carthage. And his
With
standpoint
with
in
what? Cartage?
Carthage, yes. Because this is the point where I should perhaps explain his geopolitical ideas. He has this apocalyptic geopolitical theology, where a world is divided in sea and land, and sea and both sea and land are paradigms or archetypes for creation of civilizations, and these civilizations are always in the clash, and they are always at war, explicitly or implicitly. And he believes, to cut the very, very long story short, he believes that we are living in the times of what he calls in German Endkampf, the final war of sea and land. And the ultimate civilization of the sea is, in his opinion, now the United States, while ultimate civilization of land is Eurasia. That is not Russia, but Russia with its, let's say, neighborhood in this geographical space of Eurasia. And it is Dugin's belief that there is an inevitable clash which will end up with destruction of USA, not necessarily military, but I think he would like to see, this is my, I can't prove it without quoting extensively, but I think he would prefer to see America reduced to nuclear dust. But of course, this is something that is impossible. And so what I want to illustrate with this, so he have a very concrete, albeit radical, political idea that that he promulgates, because it is sugar-coated with a whole plethora of other ideas. For instance, he is supposedly anti-imperialist because he is against American intervention in Syria. But that's not because he's on principle anti-imperialist, but because in his worldview, Syria should be one of geopolitical minions and subjects of future Eurasian empire. And in this way, a lot of people thinking that they are, let's say, it's a researching the truth, trying to make sense of things, end up victims and dupes of subversive elements like this guy. I think this is pretty illustrating example of what I mean.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, bringing it back to my original question, which wasn't very clearly formulated, but it's, I mean, the image I get is of, and this is, I mentioned to you in an email, this William Sims Bainbridge, and he's written a lot of, he works uh-huh. for the Pentagon, and he's a social engineer, and he investigated, or he wrote a book about the process church, which is an interesting correlation, because he also is a transhumanist and is promoting transhumanism, uh-huh. so it's kind of a clear overlap there between interest in quasi-satanic cults and transhumanism. But anyway, one of the things he writes about is audience cults and how they can be very useful for social engineering. He uses the example of UFO cults. You get people who believe in flying saucers. They're going to be more uh-huh. more open and responsive to a space program, which is useful for, you know, various capitalist expansionist programs, and of course, you know, militarization of space and what have you. So, but also he even talks in practical terms that these audience cults can end up, you know, creating actual little communities that might create local, you know, produce, make their own products, and they can be over time converted into uh-huh. companies and little, you know, engines of capitalism. But what I'm thinking also is a more subtle use of audience cults, which is that if people, individuals, via, as you're saying, via the internet, this has really been amped up to a whole new level here, but if people can get seeded with ideas, you know, values, concepts uh-huh, uh-huh. that are basically carriers, like I would say they're ideological carriers. They've got mm-hmm. They've got these hooks in them, like we know about Hollywood and entertainment, that it's covert propaganda, and it has all these hooks in them. If you take in the narrative, if you take in if you identify with the characters, you're essentially letting this Trojan horse into your internal kingdom, and then these little mm-hmm. troops are going to start, marching
Yes.
all through your internal system, and then you yourself can be converted into a carrier of this ideology. So, and then expand that out to an audience cult, where you get all these people who are supposedly believing in, living off the land or reincarnation, spiritual values, UFOs, the ascended masters, whatever it is. But unwittingly, they're carrying another ideological agenda, and they're spreading it further into the culture. And so I see it as kind of like this fertile land, like the social engineers are using human consciousness to till the land and to sow these seeds that they can later grow the produce that they want to grow and farm it, and then that can eventually manifest in a political movement or a shift in political, agendas that seems to have. Well, I don't know if it seems to have come out of nowhere, but it's not obvious that it's come out of you and me. If you see what I mean.
Yes, I do. And although I think when it comes to this manipulation, it doesn't even always have to be this kind of a relationship of some kind of hidden puppet masters and the masses. Masses can play themselves dumb without anybody's help also. I'm always a little wary about this conspiracy aspect. At least lately, I started really to rethink this because a lot of these conspiracy ideas on closer inspection to me at least are beginning to seem very weak. But I don't know. I think it's very hard to find a proper methodology. How would you, for instance, demonstrate that there is some elite doing this exact thing and so on? Problem is the real sources to research this are insiders, and there are precious little of those. I mean, the example you gave is, I think, valid in this sense. And this, what I said on Dugin, it's more or less the same thing. It's also a manipulation. This is a conscious manipulation. But I think what happens at one point is that the whole process acquires the life of itself. People start manipulating themselves into illusions without anybody's outside help. This is also possible, and I think this is usually the case because you have something we call zeitgeist or this spirit of the age, and spirit of the age is not something I think that humans bring about. And if the spirit of the age is nudging you in some direction, the ideas that formulate this direction will be accepted by a lot of people. And for instance, one of the ideas that is, I think, basis of this conspiracy mindset is this idea of the end of the world, of the coming apocalypse, and so forth. And people who are prone to believe in it. If they are religious, for instance, if they are members of the religion that has this strong stress on this apocalyptic aspect, they get, I think, very easily infected with secularized version of this idea. For instance, in Dugin you have this end of the impending geopolitical end of the world, which will of course not happen. But I noticed, for instance, this mindset of very closed a mindset that is very close to this. It's the mindset of the new beginning, like everything will begin anew. I saw this with Donald Trump campaign. Now, obviously, I am not in America, but I was in communication with a lot of people, and I was, of course, skeptical towards this guy. I frankly didn't know that much about it. I was appalled by Clinton's, of course, but I couldn't see why people in the grassroots US are so attached to him. What I noticed month or so into his presidentship that people who I considered really not only intelligent but commonsensical were starting to react extremely aggressively to any kind of criticism towards him. And the criticism was that he is not really a messiah. I mean, not in so many words, but I saw one guy says, ask the other guy, is Donald Trump a latter-day Constantine, meaning Constantine the Great, the founder of Byzantium?
Right.
And the other guy says, I think it's a bit of a stretch, but we should pray and hope. I mean, this is unbelievable. Look, I'm living in this, let's call it old Europe, this Eastern Central Europe. We are still primitive enough to have this kind of continuity of history. And to liken a Roman emperor to Trump, to the guy who made Christianity, who took Christianity out of the fringe and into the center, and who founded the Eastern Roman Empire. I mean, this is so ridiculous that there is no sense of criticism. And yeah. Those are people who I considered to be very knowledgeable. And in the sense, I think they are more knowledgeable than me in a lot of things, but they simply lost their mind. Or they never had much mind to speak of. But before, but they never showed it so clearly.
I forgot where we were going with this. I mean, you were talking about conspiracy, and the fact that the masses can delude themselves without any help.
I think this was one example, because if I haven't been clear, I clarify. The main gist of Trump's campaign via internet, one of the main focuses was that he's fighter against establishment.
And
they are against establishment, and then they obviously projected that he's some kind of champion fighting the deep state, which is in this conspiracy or occult politics research circles our main boogeyman.
And they
probably unconsciously start to really identify Trump with some kind of savior figure, and that was only a game. I listened to a few interviews with this Roger Stone. I think he was a campaign chief or advisor. He flat out said that this idea of selling Trump as anti-establishment grassroots guy was idea of a campaign to get him in the president seat, and then they'll ditch idea altogether. What they did, of course.
Right. Well, but one of the things that's propped it up and made it possible for people who should know better to believe it is mysticism. Like the whole Keck thing, and it's sort of, you know, scientific mysticism or whatever we're going to call it. I mean, it's chaos magic, really, but that, I mean, magic always has had, or at least since Crowley, has had a correspondence in people's minds with science. There's this quasi-scientific sort of basis for it. But whatever the case anyway, I mean, the sort of cyber revolution, aesthetic or sensibility that with Anonymous and WikiLeaks and all the other, you know, more mainstream aspects, and 4chan obviously being the underbelly of that, it seems to me that that's made it possible for people to jump the shark in that way and actually convince themselves that it's possible for an anti-establishment president to get into power, and that they're the ones who put him there.
Yes, of course. They believed, and Richard Spencer, of all people, who is the acclaimed leader of alt-right, flat out said it on one of those conferences they had. That famous Hail Trump, Hail Victory.
Right.
I don't know, maybe you heard him, heard that speech of his. And he said, among other things, that we... Keck smiled upon us, and we imagined Donald Trump into an office. And I take it, I know he takes it seriously, and I do take it seriously also. And I think this is, and this is, as you said, this clearly a sign of this post-humanist cyber sorcery. I don't know what word to use to define it anymore. What is ironic about it, and I wrote about this some time ago, precisely about this Keck phenomena. What is ironic is that alt-right is supposedly traditionalist movement. That is the movement that wants to supposedly reattach to this stream of history. And you kind of expect such people to be wary about these technological shenanigans, to be maybe not necessarily anti-technology, but you don't expect them to use the ultra progressive ideas of posthumanism to accomplish their ends. And this is what they did.
Yeah.
And I think this clearly shows that this left and right divide is not, it's really a very fuzzy thing. It seems that everything there seems to be one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And please.
No, go ahead.
I was just wanted to mention this idea of this techno magic that bring about Keck, the god, was built on idea of synchronicity.
Hmm.
Now, synchronicity will be an idea I will research a little bit more in the future. I know that Carl Jung wrote about it. He was a pioneer in research of this strange phenomena, which is not so strange. It's pretty much, it is everyday experience for some people.
Yeah.
My opinion on synchronicity is that synchronicity is not a sign of, as Jung said, a causal meaningful relation. It is a sign of chaos emerging, because synchronicity, I think, presupposes connectedness of everything with everything else. But this is not a definition of order. That is the definition of chaos proper, when everything is connected to everything.
That's interesting.
And I think I think people who experience synchronicities are not on their way up; they're on their way down, because they are losing the order of reality and sinking into disorder. And in disorder, what you see in disorder, you see everything connected, where this Keck is connected to that Shady Lie, that Italian pop song from the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Then to that random series of numbers and so forth. It's really synchronistic. I think it is real phenomena. I don't think it's a real delusion.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, It's not delusion you make up, it's a delusion you sink into. And I think that really, how can you recognize this? Because in synchronicity, synchronicity is, as if I recall correctly, Jung connects it to idea of sympatheia, this antique idea from antiquity that there is this esoteric relation between essences of things. Well, let's say some stone is related to star, and star is related to emotion, and so on. And then you have astrology, you have these old sciences of this ancient world were built seemingly upon this idea. But synchronicity is not that. And I think it's not that for the simple reason that sympatheia is vertical. That is, you have a god and everything else below him, and everything is gradually like a pyramid, ordered. There are orders of reality, higher, lower. In synchronicity, it's horizontal, with a tendency of dissolving into the direction of downwards. Because everything is connected to everything else, the most stupid I don't know, cartoon character Kick is all of a sudden God who made Trump president, and they made this for him, that song Shadeli, which is, by the way, good pop, synth pop song from the 80s, but it's not really Ave Maria. And what I want to say, everything starts to disperse. At the first sight, you have a feeling that you are catching meanings on all sides. But at some point, it gets overwhelming, overabundant, and it becomes meaningless. That's how it seems to me, at least.
Hay tres clases de hombres, los vivos, los muertos y los que navegan. O sveti Mikerec si nam rotu, mola brbitu, agvanta škotu, čapalantinu, kacaškotinu, volta temuna, vitar karinu, a more kurba, more kanaja, mola ol kraja, mola ol kraja. Barbetto, a svelto vira, amore momine dono mira, picce marette, picce mora, gli salantiru idra fora. Leva mazzu, trozzu liga, tribula picce, picce intriga, more nebo, oblof non morca, picce va surma, culce va porca. O sveti micherez non rotu, mola barbetto, a quanta scottu, ciappalantino, cazzascottino, volta temuna, vittar carino. Amore curva, amore canaia, mola o craia, mola o craia. Ma io non portit, tu slai e ura, vita non craia, ribalta dura, già passe vesto, ol rive larga, si grossal, palantino carga. Pulenze ziri, pusce le mon, avanta braz, lasca da mon, mola de fora, ciappa de drento, pusce svevo e pusce seglento. O sveti micherez non rotu, mola barbitro, aguanta scotu, ciappa lantino, cazza scottino, volta temuna, vittar carino. Amore curva, amore canaia, mola o craia, mola o craia. Lampo maiela, fiumera curent, potese le mont, rigo pulent, vitarie scaras, vitarie lord, butasse tresso, dobrie cor.
Yeah, would you say that you're a religious person?
Yes, I am. I'm Catholic. I'm Roman Catholic. And most Croats are Catholics. Not much else I can be.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I just want to clear that up because I definitely got that impression from the podcast and I'm getting it now. And I think, you know, what you're describing is what's very compelling, but I think if we go into that, we can end up very, very abstract. But there's certain things that you said that I definitely have seen for myself and can concur with. When you're talking about synchronicity, I mean, you know about the term synchromysticism, I guess.
Yes, I heard about it.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was a term that came up, I don't know, 10 years ago, right when I was getting into podcasting. It was starting with Jake Coetzee and this other guy, Goro, something or other. And, you know, right at the start, I said, well, what are they talking about? What they've just coined a term that doesn't mean anything because they're just talking about synchronicity. Like there's no difference between synchronicity and synchromysticism. So what, you know, why are they turning it into a movement? Well, they did turn it into a movement, and I've been skeptical of it from day one, and I'm still skeptical of it. But I do kind of acknowledge a difference now between Jung's synchronicity and synchromysticism, and I think it relates to what you're talking about. And interestingly, I just wrote something very similar about synchromysticism, specifically around Kubrick, because I've been looking into Kubrick's work in terms of some of the things we've touched on today, but how to create the internet as a kind of strange attractor for human consciousness in a way of well, anyway, I don't have to get into that, but a lot of the synchromystics are into Kubrick, big time. He's like their god or what have you. And one of the things I said was exactly, I think, pretty much what you said is that it's like the flip side of nihilism. Like the previous generation, the slackers or what have you, it was nothing means anything. And now this new generation is everything means something, but it's kind of the same. You know?
Yes.
it's kind of the same in that, well.
You know what my impression was about those kids on 4chan and 8chan when this cake brouhaha happened? Because they 4chan and 8chan picked up on my article on cake, and they discussed it, and I went in to see what they talk about. They're exceptionally intelligent. I think they are very, very young and exceptionally intelligent. They are not stupid. They are not, but they are warped unbelievably. This is with neo-Nazism, anti-Semitism, and so on and so forth. But they're very intelligent young people. I just wanted to interject this.
Yeah, well, this is true of the synchro mystics that I know, or whether or not they would identify as that, that they hang together and they do podcasts together. And anyway, yeah, I'd say they're unusually intelligent and insightful. But personally, I felt frustration with most of them that I've known and continue to do so with those I communicate with, because of what I see as this very futile, or not futile, because that's a big word, and we could apply that to everything, really. But self-indulgent and kind of energy-wasting pursuit of the minutiae of pop media, which tends to involve smoking a lot of marijuana, as well. And I think it's quite key, not that necessarily all of them do use marijuana to do it, but I used to smoke marijuana, and my experience was that everything became incredibly meaningful, and I would see all of these unbelievably irrefutable connections between this, that, and the other. And the rubber of my marijuana visions, well, I guess it wanted to go off into outer space. It didn't want to acknowledge there was any road there at all, because it was, well, I'd say it was dissociative, would be the easy way of putting it, but it was a self-generated reality matrix. So I'm not exactly sure where I'm going with this. Maybe I'll bring it back to the thing about conspiracy. You said about conspiracy that, I can agree and I can disagree both. Like, the first website I ever had, it was Paranoid Awareness, and the tagline or the banner, whatever, said there is a worldwide conspiracy to create the illusion that there is a worldwide conspiracy.
That's nicely said. That's
Yeah,
interesting.
I know, and I
I think that
still,
there is a lot of to it.
So I think, I mean, that obviously that's a paradox. That's why I used it, and I think that a big part of what of how we end up deluded individually and en masse is we get tricked, and we trick ourselves into creating these linear narratives and interpretations that we can then be corralled into, such as a conspiracy theory of history. Well, I don't, I think there is a conspiracy in terms of men in rooms and all that, of course. Where else are they going to meet? But in terms of the depth of delusion, control, misguidance, that we're talking about. I mean, that's one of the reasons I asked if you're religious, because if you're a Catholic, well, and you mentioned on your podcast about evil, you pretty much, if you were to use the word devil, you would pretty much mean it literally. I don't know how
Yes, I
literally,
would.
but okay, so literally, right? And that, of course, is the ultimate conspiracy theory, that there's a devil, working behind the scenes. And I don't believe in the devil, but I do believe in that the conspiracy, or whatever we're going to call it, is that deep. I mean, it is metaphysical, let's say.
One note about this. The birth of conspiracy theory has a date. It's a few years, 1796 or 7, when Abbé Barruel published his memoirs illustrating history of Jacobinism. Barruel, I don't know, have you heard of him? But our listeners maybe
No.
haven't, so I'll tell who he is. He's the first, let's say, conspiracy theorist. He's a man who put out the very very detailed exposition of French Revolution as a conspiracy of enlightenment thinkers who infiltrated, among other things, Masonic lodges and some European potentates. What is interesting about this is precisely what you said. In this book, this is written by priests, and I did a series of podcasts about it. I'm still one part due to finish it. He was a priest. In that book, devil is, this is a four-volume book, devil is not mentioned, not once. What I want to say, conspiracy theory is being born in modernity. It's a modern production where I have a feeling that is a kind of secularization of this idea of ultimate spiritual evil, where you transpone spiritual evil to some kind of clique of man.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, this is a historical fact, I would say.
In terms of evolving beliefs and perceptions.
Yeah, I don't. Well, I don't know how much it is an evolution. It is simply French Revolution was a radical. This is a radical overturn of the whole European European and Western world, and something happened. This is the point where. Where the secularization proper really took speed, and I myself do not understand not even the superficial implications of this event, because it was so huge. But what happened is that a conspiracy theory, I would claim that idea of conspiracy theory or idea of this occult politics of elite manipulating is practically born with French Revolution, with the work of Abbé Barruel and other guys, John Robison, who wrote about also at the same time as Barruel about this Illuminati plot. And Barruel is a father of the theory that Illuminati, in fact, were more the most successful subverters of all, Adam Weishaupt and Illuminati. And his book is one of the best sources on Illuminati because he relied on original documents and he relied on interviews with people who were either members or who knew Illuminists and so on. But what is interesting, and this is why I pointed out, because you said that something along the lines that conspiracy theory is a kind of reflection of the idea of devil. I'm certain it is. And what is interesting is that in modern times it exchanged this spiritual evil for human evil.
Yeah, well, and that's, as you're pointing out, I think that it's not just evil that has taken that course, because the Enlightenment was also about attributing all goodness to human beings as well.
Yes, yes.
So naturally the flip side, you know, if humans are going to take credit for everything that's good, they're going to have to also take the credit or the blame for everything that's bad.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, but what is interesting is why the Jesuit priest wrote a conspiracy theory of the destruction of Catholic Church and kingdom in France, and never once mentioned the devil. I know what you mean, but this is even, I think it goes even deeper. It is very strange. It is very atypical, you know, because as a priest, you are in a way even obliged to put that in theological context. And this guy, I read the book twice. I never found he mentions anything remotely different from pure political and even epistemological subversion and revolution. Very interesting phenomena.
Well, I think
I don't claim to have explanation.
Yeah, it definitely seems like a lead to follow. I was going to say, I think that when I mentioned evolving perceptions and beliefs, is that I mean, why I chose to phrase it that way is that I mean, how I'm seeing it now, or just trying trying to get my head around it, is that aren't the like you have changing mores, and you talk about the zeitgeist, and I would agree that this is something beyond human conscious design by definition. But then I kind of say that about everything we do is beyond our conscious design. But I what was I going to say? The maybe changing methods for changing times. So, is it possible, do you think? I know you're a Catholic, so I'm I don't know if I want to be careful, but I don't want to get stuck in a sort of a dead end, because I know that, I mean, this was happening with David Livingstone too, because he's also a religious person, and I'm not at all. But that doesn't mean that I don't have sympathy and agreement. Actually, I did have a lot with Livingstone. But anyway, the many people would say, and I might be one of them, that the idea of the devil itself was created as a way to control people.
I don't think so, but I think it was used. It was used, of course it is, and because fear of perdition in a spiritual sense can of course be used to a great extent to torture people into submission. But I think it was, and it was done by Catholic priests, by Protestant priests. Of course it was, but I think it is a little bit overemphasized in our time. I think they were not so hell-bent on scaring people into submission, but they were more really expounding that theology where devil has a very, very significant place, where evil has a significant place. I don't think that humans made the devil up, but I'm not so religious that I would not affirm that this idea can be used and was indeed used to great extent to torture people practically into submission. It is probably the most scary idea you can imagine, and if you can, in a way, present it to people with all its implications, you can scare them to hell, literally, and it is very good to manipulate. Although I don't think, for instance, this medieval notion of devil, I don't think it was really. I think that it was what it was originally, but it was misused. I give you one example of what I think. For instance, you have this idea that devil has a rule over senses, over sensible world, and over human senses, and can manipulate imagination. This is fairly mainstream theology now I'm talking about. He can influence through senses and through manipulation of fantasia, of imagination, of images we construct from the senses. And our idea is you should guard your senses. You should keep watch on what you are imagining or what you are looking at. And now you have one man who will do this properly. Without any effort, he will simply by spontaneously purify himself from bad thoughts, from imagining even bad things. But you have another man who will try to maybe to pick his eyes out. You know, to men who will try to forbid any kind of erotical imagery and so on. You will have fanatics. So I think this is simply a powerful principle and idea, and can produce diametrically opposed effects. That's what I want to say.
Butta, ciapa, drizza, forza, leva, fora, mena, orza, ala, fonda, salpa, volta, lasca, liga, mola, salta, avanta, para.
That's the end of the first part of my conversation with Branko Malek of Carly Tribune. You can find Branko's site linked in the show notes. Part two of this conversation, where we go through the door of the devil to see what's on the other side, is going to be up next Wednesday, the 26th of July 2017, at horticulture.com/liminalist. I'd like to thank Chris and Glenn for donating. That's Glenn, who likes to hear his name and is willing to pay for it. I wish there were more of you. I was looking at the stats by chance, actually. I don't choose to look at them, but they just popped up in my control panel for the podcast downloads. I noticed that it seems like an average of about 1,000 downloads for a new podcast right away within the first week. So that suggests like 1,000 regular listeners, give or take, which is probably more than I expected. And I was thinking, well, if all of those listeners donated $5 a month, I would be able to support myself with this podcast. It would mean I'd have a lot more time and things would be more interesting or different. But anyway, obviously that's not going to happen, but I would encourage those of you who've thought about it. It may be worth it. I'm not going to do that subscriber section, I don't think, ever. Part one is free, part two you got to subscribe. I just don't like it. I don't like the blueprint, the template. But it does seem as though that would be a great way to motivate people. So I'm just seeing if I can motivate you without even threatening to do that, just to show your appreciation that I don't do that firewall business. All right, thanks for listening. This is The Liminalist.